You may think this bill means the world is ending. I guarantee you it's not. The truth is this tax cut bill means a brighter future for the hardworking people and hardworking Americans, so we'll have more money in their pockets and a better shot at the American dream.
It's more like the Grinch that stole Christmas. In poll after poll and through elections in New Jersey, Virginia, and my home state of Alabama, the American people continue to send the message that they do not want this tax bill to move forward.
Debate on the House floor this morning over the Republican tax bill. The House voted, it passed. The Senate is next, and then the House may have to vote again to deal with a rules issue. I'm Jonathan Bastian, sitting in for Madeline Brand. Some Republicans are touting the new bill as a Christmas gift, with Americans getting a tax cut of more than $2,000. But in a wealthier state like California, is that really the case? To break down how the final tax bill affects us here, we have Gonzalo Fracius, professor of taxation and accounting at the UCLA Anderson School of Management. Welcome.
Thank you. How are you today?
Good, thank you. Okay, let's just get into this here. So mortgage interest deductions, this is big in California. It's also just really popular across the U.S. What we're learning is you can now deduct on new loans up to $750,000. But houses are, they're just expensive right now in California. It feels like we could be in the middle of a bubble. So how much is this going to hurt homebuyers here in California?
Well, it's going to hurt home buyers at the higher end. I think the average price in California last time I looked was something over $500,000. So for the average home buyer, having an increased deduction for mortgage interest, because if you remember under the House plan, they'd capped it at $500,000.
Right.
The Senate wanted to keep it at $1 million. Now it's $750,000. But if you're buying a home that's where your loan's going to be over $750,000, you've lost out here.
Considering that it's gone to $750,000 versus $500,000, that actually might be important for California.
I think that helps a lot of middle-income and upper-middle-income home buyers in California. But if you're trying to buy something in San Francisco or the west side of Los Angeles, chances are you're going to be hurt by this, the loss of this additional deduction above $750,000.
Okay, well, moving on to something else here. State and local tax deductions are capped at $10,000. I mean, is that better or worse than what we're used to here?
Way worse, because right now there's no limit. We are allowed to fully deduct the property taxes on our homes, and we're allowed to fully deduct either our state income tax that we pay, which is pretty high here in California, or sales tax, whichever is higher. What they're doing is they're lumping all of that into one basket and capping it at $10,000. So this is going to hurt all middle, upper middle, and to a lesser extent, wealthy families in California. The final bill is much more punitive than what the Senate had proposed. It's a real problem for New York, California, and some of the other high-tax states.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, the standard deduction is now going to be higher, $12,000 for individuals, $24,000 for couples. Could this offset things to any extent?
It will offset it in part. What's interesting is, and a lot of people haven't talked about this, they've increased the standard deduction, but they've eliminated exemptions. What does that mean? A family of four, the exemption is a little bit over $4,000, so they have a $16,000 exemption. That's gone now.
Mm.
So, yeah, they've increased their standard deduction, but they've eliminated the exemption. So it's going to be a little bit of a wash in terms of the taxable income. However, because the tax rates have been lowered at the lower categories or rates, the average middle-income family should still see a tax cut, but that could be gone when we factor in the loss of some of the mortgage interest cap or the severely restricted local tax deduction.
Okay, I mean, here's another question, though. This is the entertainment capital of the world all across Southern California here. I mean, there's a lot of freelancers who rely on various deductions. How will they fare in this new plan?
The freelancers should be helped because under the plan, flow-through businesses, and most freelancers usually operate as a sole proprietorship or limited liability company, S corporation, they are going to be able to reduce their income from these what we call flow-through entities. They're getting a 20% deduction or exclusion, if you will, so that they can, in essence, not count 20% of the income from their business. And so that will be helpful to freelancers.
Okay. And then there's also this issue of tax bracket changes. I mean, the state median income is around $63,000. So let's say you're a single person making about that. What bracket will you be in at this point?
If you're at 63,000, you should be at 12%. If you're married, if you're single at 63,000, you'd be at 22%.
Okay.
That's under the new law, and under the existing, if the law didn't change, that same person would be at 25%.
Right.
So, see, that is a tax savings for that person, which may or may not be offset by the loss of some of the other deductions.
Okay. Well, at the same time, I mean, there are also a lot of big corporations, a lot of big businesses here in California, and the corporate tax rate is cut to 21%. The argument on the right here is that this is going to create growth in California's economy. Do you think that's true?
To a certain extent, I think it is true, because you're going to have, not only are you reducing corporate tax rates significantly from 35 to 21%, you're also allowing companies to repatriate earnings at a low rate and to not be taxed on foreign earnings, which they currently are taxed on. So all of that should help businesses a lot. However, one of the benefits under the law that's provided to corporations as a way to offset international earnings, and I don't want to get too much into the weeds here, but they have some sort of punitive measures or limiting measures on those benefits for companies that have a lot of intellectual property overseas.
Okay.
Companies like Apple and Google and Facebook and all of that are not going to be as helped as much as more traditional manufacturing type companies.
Okay. How about this? As a professor whose job is to look at these things closely, who's making sense of this, for the average middle-class worker across Southern California, ultimately this is going to hurt them, or this is going to provide an extra boost to their income?
I think that the average middle-class family may see a very modest decrease in their taxes. However, that is expiring in 2025, whereas the corporate tax breaks are not expiring.
Got it.
There's obviously a lot more in this tax bill for wealthier families or corporations. For example, they tripled the what you can deduct for a luxury car that you buy for your business.
Gonzalo Fracius is a professor of accounting and taxation at the UCLA Anderson School of Management. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
All right, let's pull out another key part of the Republican tax bill that will have a big impact on California as well. The final bill would repeal a key pillar of Obamacare that requires people to buy health insurance or pay a penalty. It's called the individual mandate. And while it's deeply unpopular, health officials say it's needed to make Obamacare actually work. Under health law, California more than halved the number of people living without insurance from about 16% 3 years ago to 7% now. Joining us to talk about this is Catherine Ho. She covered healthcare for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so how will the repeal of the individual mandate affect California?
Sure. So California's been one of those blue states that really moved aggressively to implement the Affordable Care Act. And as you mentioned, our uninsured rate is now at a record low, about 7%. And there's been one study that came out of UC Berkeley that estimated about 1.7 million people here in the state would no longer have health insurance if the mandate is repealed. And that pulled some numbers from the CBO report that looked at those figures nationally.
Yeah. And is this just because, you know, a lot of, let's say, younger, healthier folks are just not going to decide to sign up, and that could throw off the economics of the situation?
That's exactly right. So there's a lot of younger, healthier folks that are buying insurance right now, and experts predict that if they did not have to, some, though not all, but some would choose not to buy insurance. And that has something of a domino effect on the rest of the individual market. The reason why the market works relatively well in California is we have a lot of people buying on the exchange or through the exchange. And when you take out some of those younger, healthier people, it'll be, you know, sicker folks who are left in that pool whose premiums may go up as a result of that.
I mean, are there any estimates that show how much the premiums could go up?
It kind of depends. Premiums are going up in the exchange kind of no matter what because healthcare costs are going up. I can't recall the exact figures of how much they are expected to go up, but I believe some of that is included in the CBO report, and there's been some independent analyses of that as well.
Yeah, so if you could just continue to clarify, I mean, what could happen to Covered California if fewer people start signing up for health insurance?
Sure. So Covered California, as we know it, would continue to operate as the state exchange. There's no reason to believe that, you know, would be discontinued. but it's expected that fewer people will buy through the exchange. One of the reasons is, as we mentioned, the younger, healthier folks who may choose not to buy through the exchange. And then, you know, if premiums are going up as a result of that, that may cause other people to decide, ooh, you know, that's a little more than I'm willing to pay for health insurance. Maybe I won't buy it.
Okay. Well, the head of Covered California has floated the idea of imposing a state-level individual mandate. This is something that Massachusetts actually proposed and passed before Obamacare. Basically, it says that it will keep if the federal mandate is repealed. So, how realistic is a state mandate here?
I would say it's not incredibly realistic, at least not in the short term. It's, as you mentioned, not a particularly popular component of the ACA. Voters are kind of split on whether, you know, they like the idea of the government requiring them to buy health insurance. So I would say it's politically a long shot, but it is something that state lawmakers here have considered before under the Schwarzenegger administration. So my guess, it'll probably be one of those things that get debated, you know, in the coming weeks or coming months, as a lot of the changes are happening at the federal level, and the state has to respond to them.
You know, one thing leading up to this, I remember being in Santa Barbara and dealing with people that would cover that area, is that there were some insurers that just simply wanted to pull out of this thing altogether, and some were offering, you know, no plans in certain areas. I mean, is that what we're seeing, a certain level of chaos that's happening in the healthcare industry after this thing is passed?
That's right. A lot of that chaos was happening, you know, in the months leading up to this, when the Republicans in Congress were, it seemed like, talking about a different repeal plan every week.
Yeah.
And you know, California has been somewhat insulated from that because Covered California has done a lot more than other states to try to make the market here work. But even so, you know, Anthem, which was a big insurer on Covered California, they pulled out of a lot of markets.
Right.
They were in almost all of them, and now they're only in, I believe, two or three regions of the state. So that was a pretty big deal. That just means if you are enrolled in Anthem plans this year or in previous years, you know, have to switch health plans, which can be very disruptive for consumers.
Yeah. Well, what are some other options we could talk about that the state could look at to keep enrollment steady? I mean, is there anything the state can do?
Sure. Well, one thing Covered California had already done this year was increase their budget for marketing and outreach, and that's really to encourage people to sign up through the exchange. I believe the figures were something like Covered California is spending 10 times as much as healthcare.gov was spending, which is kind of a stunning comparison. Another thing the state could do is provide, you know, state-level subsidies, the same, similar to what the federal government provides for subsidies, and that just means, you know, folks who are buying mostly through Covered California get their premiums subsidized.
Yeah.
They get some financial assistance.
But I'm just curious, I mean, how well does marketing something like this really work when there is going to be a lot of instability in the market? Is that even effective?
It's shown to have some effect. I mean,
yeah.
If you look at the enrollment figures for Covered California so far this year, they're up. They're not up, you know, dramatically, but they've held pretty steady. So, you know, I guess it's difficult to measure,
yeah,
you know, exactly, you know, what the direct impact is of marketing. But we do know that people, at least here in California, are signing up for health insurance, and that number is going up.
All right. Well, that's Catherine Ho. She covers healthcare for the San Francisco Chronicle. We appreciate the time.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, what legalizing pot could mean for the thousands of people convicted of pot-related felonies. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian, sitting in for Madeline Brand. Well, in a couple of weeks, January 1st, you'll be able to buy an ounce of pot for recreational use here in California. And you won't have to worry about being convicted of a crime. That, of course, is because a majority of voters supported Prop 64, the Adult Use of Marijuana Act, which passed last year. Prop 64 also made it possible for those who have already been convicted of a pot-related crime to petition to have their convictions expunged or reduced. In fact, about 4,500 people have already filed their petitions, but as many as 1 million could be eligible. Allison Margolin is a criminal defense attorney specializing in marijuana regulations, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, have you been handling some of these petitions to get rid of pot convictions?
I have. On November 8th of 2016, when we passed this initiative, the part of the initiative allowing for reductions happened immediately. Mm. So, as of that date, you could apply for reductions to a misdemeanor for basically any marijuana offense, unless there was evidence it went out of state. And that usually doesn't happen because a plea agreement usually wouldn't indicate those facts.
Yeah.
And in many cases, we actually could apply for absolute dismissals. The greatest impact for this are people who are DREAM Act recipients and people who had potential immigration problems caused by marijuana convictions. And because of this, we are able to actually completely get them dismissed, which is different than an expungement because it's an absolute dismissal, like it's clean off your record.
In this case, I mean, a dreamer is somebody who potentially could be deported for something like this, and
yes.
They could stay.
Right? And actually, I had a client like that just a couple months ago who had been in the United States since a kid.
Okay.
He had deportation hearings set because of a felony marijuana conviction 8 years ago, and I was able to convince the district attorney and judge to dismiss it totally, and now he's not going to be deported.
Well, I mean, I wonder, how do people even find out if this is available to them? Because millions could be impacted?
So basically, anybody who has a prior felony or marijuana conviction can be impacted by this. So anybody. So what I would recommend for people to do is if you've ever had a felony marijuana conviction, either call an attorney or you can go to the public defender's office and they have it set up in each of the public defender's offices to help past clients attain these reductions and dismissals.
And do you think for most of the cases, I mean, these are people that are in prison or most of them are out of prison at this point?
Most people are out of prison,
yeah.
But they have collateral consequences for employment as a result of having felony convictions.
Okay. And are we talking any marijuana related crime? I mean, not just possession of a small amount, but also serious felony convictions or of selling a lot of pot? I don't know.
Yes, we're talking about all of it.
Yeah.
We're talking about possession for sale of any quantity. We're talking about cultivation of any quantity. We're talking about transportation of any quantity. And what's really exciting is that most of the times, the way that people have done their plea agreements, it doesn't even indicate the number of plants. So let's assume someone got convicted a long time ago of cultivation felony.
Sure.
Okay. Well, now because of Prop 64, any adult can grow 6 plants without a recommendation. So if the person's plea didn't indicate how many plants that they grew, it's possible to actually get that old felony totally dismissed.
Yeah.
Because there's no evidence it was more than 6 plants.
Okay. And I can also imagine some people are thinking, are we going to suddenly see a bunch of criminals released, you know, as a result of this? People that maybe got in trouble for selling pot, but also did some other bad things as well.
No, I mean, basically with the marijuana issue, as long as people didn't have a serious strike or other serious felonies, there hasn't been, in the recent years, tons of incarceration for marijuana, but there have been these continuing disadvantages to people who were convicted of it. So it's not going to be like the release of anyone from jail. And actually, this effect took place last year. It's just going to be a matter of re-enfranchising people who have been disenfranchised because of their felony conviction.
Yeah, talk about this a bit. I mean, the getting a felony taken off your record is actually a pretty big deal. It's not just about getting out of prison, but about the impact that record can have on the rest of your life, right?
That's exactly right. And there are many people who have been basically not given a chance at legitimate opportunity because of these convictions. And what's really exciting is that Los Angeles and the state has provided even more opportunities for people with cannabis convictions to enter into the licensing system.
Yeah, how does that work?
Well, basically, under Prop 64, which was actually the imagination and creation and large part of the Drug Policy Alliance, there was a lot in there encouraging cities to make reparations to people who have been victimized by the drug war, specifically people who have cannabis convictions. So Los Angeles and Oakland, and it's very exciting here in Los Angeles because applications are coming out next week, have devised a system where people who are low income and have cannabis convictions will get priority for licensing for all different marijuana activities. And they're going to get financial assistance from the city to be able to be participating in them.
Okay. Well, at the same time, you know, the California court system is, it's overloaded. So, I mean, there will be a big waiting period, I presume, for some of this or not?
Well, actually, you know, the court system isn't as overloaded anymore because of two major things. One is Prop 64 making all these marijuana cases now misdemeanors,
right,
basically.
Okay.
The other thing is that a couple of years ago, we passed Prop 47, which reduced a lot of felonies to misdemeanors. So the court system now is actually not overloaded, and it's pretty fast to get these petitions handled. Mm-hmm. Once you file a petition, you get a court date in a couple of weeks, and then it may require additional court dates if you're trying to do, let's say, a dismissal versus a misdemeanor, but you can get this done in 2 months.
2 months.
Yes.
To get this off your record,
yes.
Potentially. Okay. So, I mean, at the same time, this is also being treated as somewhat of a social justice issue. Is that right? I mean, because poor and minority people, some say they've been disproportionately convicted and imprisoned for pot offenses.
That's right. And also in the LA system, and this is also encouraged under Prop 64, there's going to be priority given to people who are actually from neighborhoods that have been disadvantaged by the war on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And if those people become a partner with other, let's say, investors, they get to be have the first chance of getting marijuana licenses. So what's really exciting about Prop 64 is that it focused not only on the conventional social justice issues, but in creating opportunities, economic opportunities for people who have been disenfranchised. And that's what's most exciting, I think, about this entire legislation.
And it kind of seems like it's part of this larger trend. I mean, with realignment or just trying to get people with these low level offenses out of prisons, essentially, in California.
That's right. And these people don't disappear. They obviously are going to live long lives. And for the general public, we should want these people to be employed in a way that's productive for society, good for these people and their families. And now it's going to create additional tax revenues for everyone else.
Mm.
So this is very exciting, both for the people who have been disadvantaged by it, but also for the general public, because unemployment will decrease as a result of this.
Mm-hmm.
People who were unemployable will now become employable. And this is really a boon to not just them, but I think to the greater Los Angeles.
You know, lastly, I mean, has there been any blowback from people on the right who've been just very anti-pot? Have you gotten anything from them?
Well, you know what's very exciting? Going to these city council meetings is seeing how the change in the law has changed the rhetoric. And maybe there are people who feel that this is unfair, but the amount of people who actually will voice that opinion is very low. And when you go to the city council meetings, not one member of the city council will get up there and say anything but the war on drugs was a failure. And so it's an awesome example of seeing how the law actually changes consciousness. And that's what's happened here.
All right. That's attorney Allison Margolin. Thanks for swinging by.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, the story behind Guillermo del Toro's interspecies romance, The Shape of Water.
Guillermo was so influenced by The Creature from the Black Lagoon. If you ask him where the birth of this story even came from, he'll go back to being 6 years old and watching TV in Mexico on a Sunday afternoon. After church, that's right. Yeah, Sundays were for church and watching movies.
Guillermo del Toro's go-to creature actor, Doug Jones, and the cinematographer of Shape of Water are here. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Jonathan Bastian, sitting in for Madeline Brand. In the new film, The Shape of Water, a lonely, mute custodian at a top-secret government facility finds herself falling in love with the mysterious, amphibious creature being held captive there.
When he looks at me, the way he looks at me, he doesn't know what I lack or how I am incomplete.
A perfect match for a Guillermo del Toro fantasy, anyway. The Shape of Water is an ode to classic monster movies and to old Hollywood musicals and noirs. Actor Doug Jones plays the creature, or the asset as he's called. Dan Laustsen is the cinematographer. The two men sat down with Madeline a few days ago to talk about The Shape of Water, and she began by asking Doug Jones about the challenges of shooting scenes underwater and selling the whole interspecies love thing.
We had to sell the I'm in water part.
Yeah.
But you also had to sell the I'm in love part.
Which is a challenge when you're wearing a fish costume.
And you're not speaking.
And you're not speaking. My character didn't speak a word, and Sally's character was also mute. She spoke in sign language. But I will tell you what, the falling in love, not using verbal dialogue, is easier than you might think, because words can be deceiving, words can lie. But a touch and a glance of the eyes and a tilt of the head, that doesn't lie. There's something very pure and very connected about that kind of communication, we found. So, and we also...
You found, so you discovered that as you were doing
it? As you discover each other. Now, we had some rehearsal time ahead of it. We had about 3 weeks together before the film started rolling. Because there was a certain scene, I don't want to be a spoiler or anything, but there was a certain scene that required some choreography and some rehearsal for us. But during that time, we really did get to know each other very well. Because when you're on breaks or sitting on the middle of a dance floor, with a towel on your face and going, oh, I'm terrified of this. Are you? Yes, I'm terrified too. We shared our secrets and our laughs and tears, and we really built a trust for each other.
What were you terrified about?
Oh, we're doing an interspecies love story.
Oh, the sex scene.
That, yes, I was terrified of that. I'd never done that in a. I played many monsters over the years. This is my sixth movie with Guillermo. And I played creatures in all of them, multiple ones. So I've done 12 creatures for him now. Never have I had carried this kind of a love story that is all consummated all the way, you know?
Because you've never been a leading man.
Not in a monster
or
suit.
A leading
no,
creature.
That is correct. That is
and
correct.
You guys, that love sequence is just so romantic. You know, when you're touching each other, you're starting to glow a little bit.
Yeah. I
and
love
the
that.
Way we change the light, in the beginning of the movie, everything was green, bluish. Mm-hmm. In her apartment, and when you guys are coming in and falling in love, we're changing the lighting to like more golden tones and more
and
romantic lighting.
And she started wearing red bits and after
yeah, but that was
too.
After that.
That was after that. Yeah.
And the red symbolizing passion.
Yeah, but that was after that.
Yeah, but like when she touches me in a sort of a caring, giving sort of way. Once she and her friends Octavia Spencer and Richard Jenkins helped me escape from the
from the
government facility where I'm being tested. And she has me in her bathtub at home. We're finally alone with no supervision. And this little hint of love is kind of like, well, now we can actually do something about it. So the first time she touches me on the shoulder, you see lights sort of like ripple throughout my, through that area, little blue lights, sort of like an eel almost or something.
That was fantastic.
Beautiful. Was that
put in later or was that part of the costume?
I think it was a combo plan.
It was a combo thing. We tried, the guys that built the suit, they built, these UV lights into the suit. So we was lighting that with UV light.
Great. But right. And at the right time, you would tilt that UV light on me and there was like a luminous paint.
But it didn't work so well. So there was a technique between real light and CG light. Because it was too complicated to do that on the set because it was a pretty small movie, so we have to move fast. We couldn't spend too much time on stuff like that, so we have to move fast forward.
Yeah.
Because of the financing.
Yeah, exactly.
Keep going.
Exactly.
So let's talk about the lighting and the choice of color because it's saturated with greens and teals, this movie.
Yeah.
The light, the costumes, everything. And why was that the decision made? Because I've heard or I've read that you initially discussed doing this entirely in black and white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First time I heard about this movie was when we shot Crimson Peak with Guillermo del Toro as well, and you too.
He said,
I have this story I want to do. It's about a girl that cannot speak, is falling in love with a creature. And I said, all right, that sounds really fantastic. And I want to shoot in black and white. And I said, wow, of course I want to shoot black and white.
For a cinematographer, that's a dream, right?
All cinematographers in the world want to shoot black and white.
Like classic,
especially a crazy movie.
Yeah.
So we talked about that a little bit, and we couldn't do that. We couldn't find the money. So it went into a color movie, and of course that's amazing because I think it's a much, much better call. And when Guillermo was starting to make a movie, he's making this color palettes of like guidelines for all the sets. So it's coming from him. Everything in this movie is coming from Guillermo because he has this movie inside his head for many years and everybody's helping him around. So her apartment was like a kind of underwater apartment, green, steel blue. And Guillermo didn't want to have any reds until the theater, death and love. And the way we was lighting her, for example, was, she should look like a princess all the way, but she looks more and more like a princess as the movie is going on. When she, In the beginning, she looks like, you know, a normal girl, but still very nice. Mm-hmm. But as the movie's moving around, you know, it's just getting more and more romantic.
And she has more of a glow about her.
She got more glow as well.
You really achieved something beautiful.
And, you know, we shot you as well, you know, very powerful and getting more and more powerful through the movie, you know, more low angle and more dramatic lighting. It was fantastic.
Right, because I was found in the Amazon, and the locals where I was found worshipped me as a god there. That's the backstory. And so the question remains throughout the film, is he? You know, is there any truth to that?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was another challenge Dan had to, you know.
So how did you create your identity? Because, obviously, your creature doesn't speak. He makes little sounds.
Right.
But he doesn't speak.
Right. So I had to channel two things. One was the creature from the wild. And unlike other characters I've played for Guillermo del Toro before, I've been many creatures before, but he usually gets me to play something refined and gentlemanly, like Abe Sapien from the Hellboy movies or the Fawn from Pan's Labyrinth. Hand gestury and very, very postured and very well spoken. This was not that. This was an animal from the wild, but with that backstory of he was worshipped as a god. And certain fantastical things happen when he's around. Like I put my hand on Richard Jenkins' head, and then the next day he's growing hair.
I'm telling you, my hair. It's my hair. Look at my arm. The wound. It's like it was never there. Look at that. You said that, you know, he was worshipped like a god. Now, is he a god? I don't know if he's a god. I mean, he ate a cat, so I don't know. I don't know, but... I mean, we have to keep him around a while.
Even though I'm being tested at a government facility, I'm being beaten down, I'm dying slowly. So I have to go through an animal who's, you know, on his way out, but I'm made of something more, something different, something mysterious. So that was my inner conflict I had, and falling in love at the same time, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot.
And that's a very part.
A lot to play without speaking a word. So we did have
part
to.
Part of it, isn't it?
Yeah,
falling in love.
It really was. That was the part of it. Yeah. Guillermo has said this movie is a love letter to love and a love letter to cinema. It was shot like a musical, like a classical old film.
Yeah, it was.
And it's like a combination of genres, it feels like.
And then you see the Richard Jenkins character, he's obsessed with old musicals.
Yes, exactly. Right.
And so he's constantly watching them on TV.
Yes, yes.
And this takes place in the early 60s.
62,
yeah. 62, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So old is, what, 20 years previously? The 40s musicals?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I will say that I found it really, just this detail, really poignant, that after she has her love scene with you, and she goes off to her job, and she's in the bus, and she's looking out the window, and it's raining.
Oh. And she's drawing her finger on the, and the droplets follow her finger?
Yes.
Beautiful.
On the window, the droplets follow her finger.
Yes.
And that just, the rain seemed so beautiful then.
Some of that rain is computer rain. It's a CG ring.
You're just ruining it for me.
But you know, I have to tell the truth. I can lie for you, but I don't. I'm saying some of the rain was, you know. And you know, that's the scene actually we try to light very, very old-fashioned Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, she have a spotlight straight into her face. And you're not doing that anymore. But we just figured out, let's go that way because she has to look like a million. Mm-hmm. You know,
because she's glowing. She's
exactly.
So happy.
And so we did that. You know, we put an old-fashioned, you know, Hollywood trick.
Yeah.
A 300 light just above the camera and just light it into her beautiful eyes.
Why is that an old-fashioned Hollywood trick? Why isn't that done anymore?
Because people did it, you know, for many years, and it was just getting too unrealistic. And you know, everybody was coming into this. We want to make a movie that looks so naturalistic. And, you know, we're shooting a movie without any lights and all. You know, you've heard all those stories.
Yeah.
But Guillermo and me wants to go the opposite way. We want to make a really artistic movie. We want to make a movie where you're trying to paint with the light and paint with the colors. So we was trying to tell a story with the light and the camera movements. That's the reason it works so well, I think, because it's not realistic at all.
So, but you're aware of the artificiality.
Oh, yeah, all the time, of course.
And you don't care because it's magical.
It's magical. We want to do it as...
It's a fairy
tale. Fairy tale powerful
yes.
things as possible.
Well, because Guillermo has said that, you know, when you have a creature in a movie, you have to put the creature at the bullseye of your chart, of how you're going to decorate and design that movie. So his production design started with the creature, and he kind of built out from there, as he's described
exactly.
it, with the color palettes and the shapes and the world. If you put that same creature in a Lifetime movie, it's not going to look right at all. It won't fit. It won't even fit. So this fantastical lighting and the the color palette and everything was kind of grew out from the creature. And so I did look natural. I looked like I belonged, you know, in the movie that I was in.
Yeah.
So that's all due to them.
For sure. And that's the way the movie is opening underwater. You know, it's just telling something is weird here. It's not like, this is not like we're coming in underwater, coming into an apartment, and then we are coming into a weird world.
It's not a documentary.
It's not a documentary at all.
Exactly.
That's for sure.
It's not a nature documentary.
Yeah. No, it is not.
But so it's also you suspend your disbelief and it makes the love story seem realistic, that you could believe that this would happen.
As only Guillermo del Toro could pull off, I think, but Guillermo was so influenced by The Creature from the Black Lagoon. If you ask him where the birth of this story even came from, he'll go back to being 6 years old and watching TV in Mexico on a Sunday afternoon.
After church.
That's right. Yeah, Sundays were for church and watching movies. They would have a monster movie marathon on all day. And when he saw The Creature from the Black Lagoon for the first time as a six-year-old boy, he was mesmerized. The image that stuck in his head was Julie Adams swimming at the top of the surface of the water in her white bathing suit and the creature swimming under her, unbeknownst to her.
Mm-hmm. That's like Jaws.
A terrifying image for most of us, but to Guillermo, it was the most beautiful romantic thing he had ever seen. He fell in love with Julie Adams. He fell in love with the creature all at the same time. And he thought to himself, as a six-year-old boy, not knowing any better, I hope they get together.
So it took him like 45 years to pull it off.
So that's what he said. So 46 years later, he's finally righted that wrong. Yeah. Got them together.
And he did it really well. Together with you guys. Really, you know, well. It's fantastic.
Yeah. He made it work. He made it work and feasible. You do root for this couple.
No, you don't think it's a creature. You think it's a person. It's not a human being, but, you know, it's just...
But I think that's another del Toro trait, though, is he has a monster on all of his call sheets. And he said that, I will always have a monster on my call sheet. But I think what his monsters to him are beloved. He loves his monsters, and the creatures in his movies are not the actual monsters. They're often a person who's getting it wrong. In our case, it was Michael Shannon's character, Strickland, who's the big bad boss.
He's the enemy.
And he has monster-like tendencies way more than I do.
The thing we keep in there is an affront. Do you know what an affront is, Zelda?
Something offensive.
That's right. And I should know. I dragged it. Filthy thing out of the river muck in South America all the way here. And along the way, we didn't get to like each other much.
So the underdog, the other, is the theme that he really is so good at exploring and telling. And that this movie is all about that. Sally Hawkins playing a mute, and disabilities in the 60s were not looked upon like they are now. Her best friend, Octavia Spencer, is a black woman in the 60s. And her next-door neighbor is a gay gentleman who's closeted and can't come out of the closet in that era either. He finds a way to write stories for all of those characters to come out on top and for the underdog to triumph somehow over the authority figure that is getting it wrong that day.
Mm. Or the underfish.
The underfish, exactly. whichever animal, but it's under.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. That's actor Doug Jones and cinematographer Dan Lausen. Their film, The Shape of Water, nominated for 7 Golden Globe Awards, including Best Motion Picture Drama. It's in theaters now.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian, sitting in for Madeline Brand. On August 31st of this year, President Trump ordered the closure of the Russian consulate building in San Francisco. It was retaliation for Vladimir Putin decreasing the amount of personnel working at U.S. diplomatic facilities in Russia. And while we often think of consulate buildings as bureaucratic places where we get visas for passports, the story of this Russian building is much more complicated. Zach Dorfman wrote about this in Foreign Policy magazine, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan.
So, Zach, this was one of 3 Russian consulate buildings in the U.S., and you say that it was by far the most important. So why is that? And can you also just give us a brief history of this building there?
Sure. Well, I think it was important insofar as it was first the oldest and longest continuously running consulate, Russian consulate in the United States. So after the embassy in D.C. was opened up, San Francisco was the first place that Russia opened up a consulate when it was still the Soviet Union. And it was important also because there was a unusually high level of espionage activities that were emanating from it. And in terms of the building itself, what's really useful to understand is that it is a large, intimidating, and actually quite beautiful building perched high atop a hill in one of San Francisco's most prestigious zip codes. And it has, and this is quite important actually, it has direct lines of sight to the Pacific Ocean.
Right. And one thing you mentioned in this article is when you looked on the, you know, at this building, you could see tons of antennas and different things on top of that building, which maybe gave away this idea that there was definitely some surveillance going on out of that place.
Exactly. There was a lot of attention when the Trump administration ordered the closure surrounding the fact that there was smoke belching from the roof of the building because Russian diplomats, undercover intelligence officers were burning up materials. But the real giveaway about the kind of activity that had been occurring at the consulate for many, many years was the number of antennas, rays, strange little shacks that had been built up. And in conversations that I had with multiple former intelligence officials, the consensus was that the Russians were using this building as a secure encrypted communications facility.
Yeah. So talk about exactly what they might have been looking for, because there's a lot of theories you write about in this article. And one of them, I'll just lead you in this direction here, is that maybe they were looking for a series of underground communication nodes or fiber optic cables under the ground that maybe, you know, that American intelligence officers or military bases were relying on. Is that right?
It is, yes. And so what the former intelligence community officials with whom I spoke said was that there was a long-running effort, they believed, by these Russian intelligence officers, some of whom, but not all of whom, were under diplomatic cover working out of the consulate itself, to go out and map out the points where data was being transferred underground in these fiber optic cable nodes. And they were particularly interested, the Russian suspected Russian spies, of trying to find these nodes near military bases. And this was part of a long-running effort, according to the analysis and suspicions of the U.S. intelligence community, to comprehensively map out the U.S. fiber optic cable network and potentially military command and control system. And it is also possible that they were then trying to transmit that data via these encrypted facilities in the consulate to Russian submarines or fishing boats or other communications facilities offshore.
Yeah, and one reason they were trying to find these cables near the military bases is that if they could find a way to also sever those lines, it would essentially cripple or paralyze the ability for, you know, Americans working in different military posts to communicate with each other.
Exactly, and this is a little. This is a kind of disquieting part of the piece when I was reporting it out. In particular, this notion that in case of a potential future military confrontation, that these coordinates would potentially be given out to Russian intelligence officers or agents that were, you know, hiding within the U.S. in various capacities, and then they would cut the grid, and it would greatly cripple U.S. military capabilities.
I've got to mention this because it's both strange, unsettling, and kind of hilarious. Some of the things you talk about, these Russian operatives doing things like walking out onto random beaches in their suits and holding up these electronic devices in the air. People are like, what are they doing? Or this one is even crazier. Russians, they'd park at gas stations, but they would not buy gas. Instead, someone would get out of the car and walk to a nearby tree, walk around the tree a couple times, then get back in the car and leave. I mean, it sounds nuts, but it was worrisome to American intelligence officials.
Yeah, I mean, this I also found this to be a fascinating part of the story, reporting it out, and it does have a slightly comic air to it, but it was also quite worrisome, and that was partly because, you know, the U.S. intelligence community people couldn't necessarily figure out off the bat what these guys were up to. And they would do, they would repeat these same behaviors at the same gas stations multiple times.
Right.
Now, certain theories emerging, but one was that they were actually just trying to confuse their you know, counter spies, FBI counterintelligence that was tailing them. The other one was that they were, in the case of Stinson Beach, potentially sending or receiving information through small devices that they had in their hands. But yeah, these odd behaviors, apparently, according to former intelligence community officials, have been going on for at least a decade.
So let's talk about what all of this could mean kind of right now in the present. I mean, we have heard a lot about the Russians meddling in the recent presidential election. Do you think any of those operations, the ways in which they could meddle, that any of that happened out of that San Francisco building, or really they were doing other stuff out of there?
No, I asked this question to multiple sources, and the operation to map out the fiber optic network seems distinct. Now, that said, it's important to understand the long-running Russian interest in Silicon Valley and in the companies and firms and venture capital institutions out here. And what I was told was the Russians didn't necessarily become so adept at employing social media in the United States without learning from institutions or individuals within the Bay Area. And of course, these people might have had no idea with whom they were speaking.
Yeah.
But it's important to, you know, to understand that there's a learning curve for other cultures to adapt their influence operations to an American audience. And I think in that respect, Russia's operations in the Bay Area may have been quite useful for
right.
them for the 2016 election.
Zach Dorfman is a senior fellow at Carnegie Foundation for Ethics and International Affairs, and he wrote about the Russian consulate for Foreign Policy magazine. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Jonathan.
All right, Christian Bordahl joining us now for listener feedback. But first, that should be a spy novel, right?
Yes.
That's
it's
just really, too good.
It's really amazing.
Yeah. All right, what'd you hear today?
Well, you talked earlier about recreational pot becoming legal here in California on January 1, and people who have pot-related convictions
yeah.
petitioning to get them expunged or reduced. I just asked the simple question of our listeners whether they have any concerns, see any
sure.
possible downsides to legal pot. Tatiana Kristen said, "I'm all for it, but I'm already unappreciative of the overzealous use in my tiny apartment complex such that it permeates the common areas and creates a gnarly haze.
Right.
I don't imbibe and don't wish to, even secondhand."
The smell is legit. We have this problem up in Carpinteria, Santa Barbara. Continue, though. Where they grow a lot. Yep.
B-Buddy says, "Long lines at dispensaries January 1 and new patients not knowing or having dispensary etiquette."
Interesting.
I'm not sure what dispensary etiquette is. I probably wouldn't have it either.
We're going to find out, though, I have a feeling in a couple months.
A lot of people talking right. about also, you know, cupcake shortages and that kind of
oh,
thing.
Oh, no. Well, with that, we were going to follow up on. All right. That's all for today. I'm Jonathan Bastian in for Madeline Brand, and we'll see you soon.